ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Thursday, the 19th of February. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. The ABC can reveal new details of the situation currently facing the Australians connected to Islamic State who are stranded in northeastern Syria. The 11 women and 28 children have been in the Al-Roj camp for several years. The government's temporarily blocked one of the women from entering the country. The rest have been issued with passports, but the group's attempt to return home on Monday was blocked. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem.
Mel, good morning. Well, an official at the Al-Roj camp has told the ABC that the imminent movement of this group of 11 women and 23 children on Monday morning was known to both Syrian and Australian authorities. Now, we've been reporting for a few days now that the group had Australian passports issued to them and they were on hand when they left Al-Roj in vans. We have had some further detail on those travel documents as well. They are being described to us as single-entry passports, so not passports in the usual sense, but certainly documents which would at least get them to Australia if they managed to make that journey. The last time the ABC got access to Al-Roj was in January last year, and two of the women who we believe are in this cohort said at the time that Australian officials had visited in the second half of 2022 to carry out health and DNA checks. And that's probably what's led to this situation where such documents could be issued to the lawyers of these women and children as opposed to them physically going to an embassy. It's also in line with this repeated insistence from the Australian government that it's only doing what it has to do to comply with its legal obligations here. The Al-Roj staff have also given more detail about the journey on Monday. They say that the message which was passed on to the armed Kurdish escorts who were travelling with this convoy, which prompted them to turn around, was that they could be targeted by Syrian government forces if they continued their journey onwards to Damascus. That's evidence of just how fragile this situation is in this part of the world, weeks after Syrian forces swept through areas which had been controlled by the Kurds for the best part of a decade. But when these women and children left Al-Roj on Monday, camp staff effectively believed they were gone for good and they'd already started demolishing some of their tents, which means that once they've turned around and returned to Al-Roj, some have had to start bunking in together.
So it's quite a confusing situation. Do we have any indication as to whether they'll try and move again and how that might work if one of them has a temporary exemption order against them? Are they going to stay as a group? What are we expecting?
Well, yes, we know that one is now subject to this temporary order, but that applies just to this individual, not even to their children or any of the others. So there aren't necessarily those impediments in the same way, at least not yet. The challenge will be the difficulty they're facing actually trying to leave the camp itself and get to Damascus or any other location. The Al-Roj official said it was upon the family members who tried to arrange this trip in the first place to coordinate that travel with the Syrian government. It wasn't up to them to do that sort of work, and that they're the ones who will make sure that they can actually get through roadblocks and the like and travel onwards. Given the effort which has been expended so far, the deep fear that people have about the future of places like Al-Roj and the moves by Syrian authorities to close some other camps in the country and relocate the residents, you'd have to say, Mel, that staying put doesn't seem to really be an option here.
That's Matthew Doran in Jerusalem. National security experts say the best way the federal government could deal with these stranded Australians would be to bring them back. Here's political reporter Sarah Tomevska.
For almost 7 years, a group of 11 Australian women and their 23 children have lived in Syria's Al-Roj detention camp, held over their links to Islamic State fighters. The group tried to leave on Monday carrying Australian passports, but Syrian authorities turned them back. It's renewed debate in Australia over their fate, as Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke confirmed one so-called ISIS bride has been barred from Australia under a temporary exclusion order.
This individual is somebody who migrated to Australia under the Howard government, received citizenship under the Howard government, and went to Syria under the Abbott government.
Temporary exclusion orders, or TEOs, keep people who present a national security risk out of Australia for up to 2 years. Since 2019, 9 TEOs have been issued. But under the law, if someone applies for a return permit, it must be granted. The minister can still delay their entry to Australia by up to 12 months.
Some of them will have to weigh up whether or not the reality of coming back to Australia is that they won't be living at home because of criminal charges that will be brought.
John Coyne is the Director of National Security at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. He says temporary exclusion orders don't override a government's legal obligations to its citizens.
It doesn't remove citizenship. It buys time for government to establish how it will deal with these individuals.
Michael Shoebridge is the Director of Strategic Analysis Australia. He says the government has legal and moral obligations.
Well, under international law, citizens have a right of return to their home country. And the Trump and Biden governments urged other countries to take their citizens home, prosecute any adults who'd committed crimes, but provide care and support for the children. The children are more like refugees, but we talk about them like they're all baby terrorists.
Both men argue the group should be repatriated and dealt with onshore on a case-by-case basis. Here's John Coyne again.
What is better? Having these people radicalised and living in Syria with no supervision and with a growing dislike for Australia and the West because of this, or to bring them back to Australia and to allow them the opportunity to get the sort of services and be supported.
Shadow Home Affairs Minister John O'Dunham is calling for new laws to prevent all 11 women from entering the country.
We would be very open to working with the government on further legislative measures that empower the government to prevent people that pose a risk to our country from entering our country if that risk is substantiated.
Shadow Home Affairs Minister John O'Dunham there, ending that report by Sarah Temevska. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg is giving evidence in a landmark US trial over social media addiction. Platforms have been sued over their effect on the mental health of young people, with the plaintiff in this case alleging the company sought to profit by getting children hooked on social media. America's editor John Lyons is in Washington. John, can you take me through what's at stake in this case?
Well, what's at stake, Mel, in this case in Los Angeles is essentially the business model of Meta, of platforms like Facebook and Instagram and YouTube and others. Now, many parents have gathered in Los Angeles at the courtroom, and the argument from the parents and the 20-year-old woman who's at the center of this particular case, and this is all before a jury, with Mark Zuckerberg having to give evidence as well, is the argument is that Meta and these platforms have deliberately designed their own platforms, the algorithms and so forth, and what they put on people's feeds, etc., to be addictive. So it's almost like the old principle of years ago of the argument about smoking and the tobacco lobby and worse cigarettes, if used as intended, damaging to your health. Now, the parents here and the 20-year-old woman is essentially arguing that I used your platforms as designed and they had a serious impact upon my mental health because of an addiction. Meta, in their defense, will be arguing that this woman's own mental health issues occurred well before she got on the social media. And so before a jury played out in public will be an examination of an issue that I think interests all of us in the modern age, social media. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it both?
John, we've seen plenty of pushback against the social media companies, you know, be it through attempts at legislative means, through public campaigns. Why is it that this legal case is generating so much interest?
Well, it's a watershed case for the social media companies because there's the 1,500 or so other cases of a very similar nature in the queue ready to go. And some people wonder, why would Mark Zuckerberg, who doesn't like public appearances, why would he put himself up in front of a jury? The reason for that is that if Meta loses this case, then there could be this domino effect right across the United States and, in fact, other parts of the world. So they're trying to shore this up with the sandbags. And they've sent in Mark Zuckerberg to look those 12 jurors in the eye and say, you all use social media in one way or the other. If used properly, it's good. If you abuse it like anything, like alcohol, like motor cars, it can be damaging. And the reason is parents have come from around America, so it's generated this massive focus. Is social media terrible for modern society, or is it something that's made our lives better?
John Lyons in Washington. The federal government is facing renewed pressure over its handling of the economy, with criticism it's spending too much and pushing up inflation. Figures out yesterday show wage growth is slower than the rate of inflation. And today, the latest unemployment figures will be released, which will be factored into the Reserve Bank's considerations on interest rates. David Sparks reports.
Among these workers rushing through central Melbourne, it's hard to find anyone who feels the economy is on track.
I definitely think it slowly feels like it's declining. I think inflation's up.
To what extent do you think inflation is the government's fault?
I mean, at the end of the day, they had opportunities to stop spending money. They've continued.
Groceries, I spent $380 at Woolies 2 days ago.
What about your rent or your accommodation or your mortgage?
That went up by $170 at the end of last year.
Do you feel like the economy is being managed well?
No.
While wages have increased over the last 12 months, the latest figures show it's not enough to keep up with the rising cost of living. It comes amid warnings from the International Monetary Fund about public sector spending and debt, and criticism from the former chairman of the Reserve Bank, Philip Lowe. He's reportedly blamed government handouts for driving interest rates up, and he's also pointing to the government's failure to act on productivity. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, is defending his record.
Spending as a share of the economy has come down from almost a third of the economy when he was the governor, now to closer to a quarter of the economy. We've got real spending growth down from averaging 4.1 to averaging 1.7. We've delivered two surpluses.
Lucy Ellis was an assistant governor at the Reserve Bank and is now chief economist at Westpac. She says there's been growth in spending on things like childcare, aged care and the NDIS, but the causes of inflation are complex.
What actually happened in the back half of 2025 is that private sector demand, which had been weak, picked up a bit faster than everyone expected. So public sector demand growth actually was slowing during that period, and we expect that to continue as more of these infrastructure projects complete. But what actually happened is households finally had a bit of extra income and were able to spend that, and there was a bit more business investment as well.
Today, another crucial set of data is on the way, the January jobs figures, and they could increase the likelihood of a second interest rate rise this year. Opposition leader Angus Taylor, along with his new shadow treasurer Tim Wilson, are trying to convince voters that the Albanese government has failed the economic test. Political analyst Mark Kenny is with the Australian Studies Centre at ANU.
Wages growth has been part of Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer's story, having wages growth above inflation. You know, difficult to achieve in the modern economy, but that has been there, and that, of course, has now slipped away. And the opposition, which is looking to really zero in on the economy, has something it can hang its hat on at the moment.
The Reserve Bank's next decision on interest rates will be on the 17th of March.
David Sparks reporting. The US mining giant Alcoa has agreed to pay a $55 million fine after unlawfully clearing parts of Western Australia's Northern Jarrah Forest. Environmental groups, though, doubt the fine will change Alcoa's behaviour. Angus Randall reports.
The Northern Jarrah Forest, south of Perth, is one of the most biologically diverse ecosystems in the country, home to multiple species of endangered black cockatoo and the world's only Jarrah forests. But it's what's under the ground that's putting this forest under threat. Bauxite. Alex Douglas from the Wilderness Society WA says American mining giant Alcoa is causing irreparable damage.
They've been found to be mining within 10 metres of black cockatoo significant trees, ultimately killing a tree that was over 400 years old.
Alcoa has cleared large parts of native forest in its search for the aluminium ore. The federal government has ruled some of this clearing between 2019 and last year was illegal, and fined Alcoa $55 million. Environment Minister Murray Watt says it's an unprecedented amount of money.
In previous cases where we've had companies pay what are known as enforceable undertakings for this kind of activity, we've been talking about a few million here or there.
Alcoa reported an $18.1 billion profit last year, making the fine roughly equivalent to what the multinational mining company earns in a day. Jess Boyce is from the WA Forest Alliance. Her biggest concern is that the federal government has allowed Alcoa to continue what it calls limited land clearing for the next 18 months while environmental assessments over the company's actions are underway.
Ensure that they wait until the state and federal government can adequately assess the impact of their mining on the Northern Jarrah Forest before any further clearing is undertaken.
Murray Watt admits the 18-month approval is not ideal, but Australia needs the minerals.
The mining that occurs by Alcoa and the bauxite and gallium that it either currently produces or will produce is important at a national level, not to mention the 6,000 or so jobs that rely on those mining operations.
In the meantime, the $55 million fine will go towards conservation initiatives such as strengthening invasive species management and ecological offsets to preserve the remaining habitat in the area. But Jess Boyce says once this land is cleared, there's no coming back.
Research shows that the Northern Jarrah Forest cannot be rehabilitated after it's mined for bauxite.
Kane Moyle is the Director of Regulatory Approvals at Alcoa.
We maintain that we have conducted our operations in accordance with the federal environment law.
He says Alcoa's operations don't impact old growth forest.
We also avoid the critical habitat for things like the cockatoo species, so nesting trees, significant trees and roosting trees. They are all already protected in terms of our operations.
The federal government is considering extending Alcoa's bauxite mining operations in WA until 2045.
Angus Randall reporting. Captain John King Davis is considered one of Australia's greatest Antarctic explorers. But even though his name has been immortalised on the icy continent, he ended up being buried in an unmarked grave in Melbourne. Later today, a ceremony will be held at his final resting place to unveil a new memorial stone and plaque honouring his legacy. Antarctic reporter Jarno Gibson has the details.
The adventurers were aboard. Dr. Mawson and Captain Davis were on the bridge, and a great crowd had gathered to see us off.
That's the voice of renowned photographer Frank Hurley, recounting the start of an extraordinary journey as he, Sir Douglas Mawson, and Captain John King Davis set off from Hobart, bound for Antarctica in 1911. The voyage was one of several made by Captain Davis, including an earlier trip to Antarctica as second in command of Ernest Shackleton's expedition on the Nimrod.
I believe it would be very true to call him one of our great Antarctic explorers.
Rebecca Jeffcoat is the president of the Inari Club, the Association for Australia's Antarctic Expeditioners.
His name is attached to one of the three Australian Antarctic stations. So we have Casey, Mawson and Davis.
The Davis Sea is also named in his honour, but 3 years ago, the Inari Club received some surprising information.
We've discovered through a member of the public, really, who was very interested in John King Davis and had read his autobiography, that when she went looking for his grave, found that it was totally unmarked.
That member of the public was Alison Hutchison, who had read Captain Davis's book High Latitude 2 decades ago.
I was just thoroughly captivated by his engaging writing style and his courage, also his leadership style.
After reading the book, she decided to pay her respects at his gravesite at the Melbourne General Cemetery, where she knew he'd been buried after his death in 1967.
I identified the site on the map, which was given to me from the Melbourne General Cemetery, and all that I found at that time was bare earth and some bushes. So I was very disappointed, hugely disappointed.
But it wasn't until 2023 when she heard an ABC story about another Antarctic expeditioner whose unmarked grave had belatedly been fitted with a commemorative plaque that she decided to reach out to the Inari Club.
I think it's time that we had his name on his own last resting place.
Rebecca Jeffcoat says that wish will finally be realised today when the Inari Club hosts a commemorative ceremony to formally dedicate a new grave monument to Captain Davis.
I think it's just really important to recognise him for his amazing achievements. Like, we all know the names of Mawson and Shackleton, but I think you know, he should be up there in lights with them as well.
Inari Club President Rebecca Jeffcoat ending that report from Jarno Gibson. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When Coles told you that prices were down, were they really? Well, that's a matter now before the federal court, with the competition watchdog arguing consumers have been misled. Today, Consumer Affairs reporter Michael Atkin on what we've heard so far. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.